Today is Tuesday, March the 22nd, 2005, and we welcome you to this committee this morning. And we have a large number of proposed House bills to go through. But first, we'd like to recognize those who have served in our military and ask you to please stand.
You're here.
Thank you so much. He's helped. I'm not sure where Representative Hunt is today, but perhaps he'll be here shortly. Okay, first off this morning, we'd like to ask if there's any general public testimony. Would you come forward, young man, and be seated? For the record, would you state your name?
Cole Fetters.
And where do you live, Mr. Fetters?
In Amity.
Oregon?
Yeah.
Okay, and what is your testimony today?
I'm thankful for the soldiers that fought for us to keep us free, so we could be free.
Thank you so much. I'm not sure if they heard it, but you might say it again so those in the back could hear.
I'm thankful for the soldiers who fought for us to keep us free.
Well, thank you so much, and we appreciate your having the courage to come today and being here. Thank you very much for that testimony. You're excused.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, any other general testimony today? Okay, if not, we're ready to begin. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2737.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2737 creates an Oregon Military Family Relief Program within the military department. It funds the program through charitable checkoff on Oregon personal income tax return forms. It establishes as a purpose of the program to write grants to members of the immediate families of federally activated National Guard and Reserve members, as well as to demobilized members of the Oregon National Guard.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Administrator, and I'd like to call Colonel Mike Cohen.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. The House Bill 2737 is one of many good bills that I've seen come up this session that I think if it was passed and actually funded, it would probably do a lot of good for a lot of Oregon National Guardsmen, which we certainly would support. There's other bills that are similar to this, and I think you're going to hear one of those later today, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that this bill represents about as much of the goodness as we could figure out on how to do a relief fund, which primarily is the tax checkoff, which would help resource it. And that's going to be the key. We, as a department, don't have this in our budget. We have a relief fund right now. That relief fund is donated money from individuals, primarily our membership, who donate to that fund, and then we use it for those relief purposes. So it is happening now, but it's on a very limited scale. However, I will tell you right now, this fund is as healthy as it's ever been, clearly because of the activity and the deployments that we've had, and we've been able to help out a good number of individual soldiers and their families during some rather really tough times. So having said that, I know there's a fiscal impact. It's not in the governor's budget, and therefore I can't sit here before you today and tell you that I would support this bill because it's not in my governor's budget, who I work for. So other than that, it's good language, though. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel Caldwell, have you had to designate another employee to be able to handle the fund that's been donated to you now? I'm worried about the FTE for managing administering this fund.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I think we put down as our fiscal impact 0.25% of the FTE would be needed to administer that, which is a very, very slight impact. I don't think we could have made it probably any less than that, and being honest, that it would take at least somebody to have some time to do that. Right now, we absorb most of that relief fund that we administer with other employees. We don't go out and hire somebody to run the relief fund that we have. We absorb it. We have volunteers that come in. That may even be excessive, 2.25%. I mean, in all honesty, but I think in fairness, we had to put something to say that, yeah, it's going to take somebody some time to, you know, keep the books, keep the records, because it needs to be audited, it needs to be accounted for, and that sort of thing. So I think if you total the people that answer the phone, the people that take in money, the people that do the audit, it's probably a quarter of a percent of a manpower, 25%.
And Colonel Caldwell, if you wouldn't mind, do you have a copy of this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you look at the first page? And I want to thank the Representatives Barnhart and Farr and Senator Walker who brought this bill. To start with numbers, line 7, first concern, the immediate family, and in the military, what is the definition of an immediate family?
Madam Chairman, typically the immediate family is a spouse or a child. There's one of the two. I suspect if you're single, and you know, we have what we, you know, when we sign up, we have who is your survivor benefits go to. And it can go to anybody, but it's pretty typical that young men and women put down their mother or their father as opposed to a spouse because they don't have one at that stage. And you might want to, if you were going to amend something, we would define it as whoever they designated as their recipient of
Estate, if something happens?
Yeah, it's a term I should have.
Okay. And then if you go to the next two lines, it says, a member of the Oregon National Guard has been ordered to federal active duty for more than 30 days. And being that this is, you know, a military family relief program, I'm concerned about that technology, terminology, not technology, terminology.
Limitation,
Yes, federal duty for more than 30 days, whereas in this committee we have just established, you know, it could be one day of foreign duty for veteran designation. And also, is it necessary for us for the individuals to be ordered to federal active duty? I mean, I can see the Guard on these horrendous fires or in Florida or, you know, needing help because they've been taken from their jobs and away from their families. And
well, Madam Chair, I think you're right. You're certainly tuned in with respect to what occurs in an average Guardsman's career and life. I would probably recommend that you strike lines 8 and 9. Our relief fund operates 365 days a year for all members of the National Guard and their families. We don't limit it on the only limitation on it is funding, and the requirement is you have to have a bona fide need, and that can happen any time of the year at any certain. And so if you have a bona fide need, then we distribute funds based on that bona fide need.
And how is that done? Is there a committee? Is there a board that determines if it qualifies?
Yes, ma'am. There is our process right now is we have a board of directors. It's a separate 501c3 that we have set up. It's standalone. It is administered basically through our personnel director. He has one in his right hand staff administrator as the banker, if you will, as a treasurer. He sits on the board along with one sergeant major and one retiree. And the three of those folks meet as needed, but generally they meet once a month on a regular basis, and they have a treasurer too, I'm sorry. There's four of them. They meet and they look at the applications. They can meet over the phone, they can meet email, otherwise it doesn't matter. Application has to come through a command, through the chain of command. So if we get a phone call from, you know, Johnny Jones from Sutherland, Oregon, says I need money now, well, unless his chain of command has verified it, they don't consider it. So the chain of command must verify the bona fide need, and they determine if it's a bona fide need or not. And that chain of command signs off. In a couple instances where we've had rear detachments and we haven't had the command, they've been deployed to Iraq, rear detachment then assumes that responsibility and validates the need. And if the need is accurate in there, we can usually turn it around within 24 hours. Sometimes we've done it in less than 8 hours. And it depends. We have separate. We have grants and we have loans, and so we grant money in certain instances and we loan money. We've used it on many occasions. Best example I can give you is after the horrendous fire season we had in 2002. Out of over 3,000 paychecks we put out, we had one paycheck, state paycheck now, that got screwed up, and I mean it just went from ridiculous to the sublime, and this individual didn't have any money, and his family didn't have any money. And we recognized the problem. We wrote a check that afternoon, sent it to the spouse, had it hand couriered to the spouse. She got a deposit, and she gave us a check back for the same amount. We said, quick, if we get your pay unscrewed, not your fault, our fault, then we'll cash your check because it's going to be deposited. And we do that occasionally, too, as an immediate relief. So it works quite well, and it's very streamlined. It's very efficient these days, and we've had good luck with it.
Would you consider giving us some input? Every member would qualify, how that should be worded. Do they need to be a member of the Guard for, I don't know what your initial training is. Do you need to get through 90 days or so you know you've got stay in power? I'm not sure how, when a person should qualify for this grant or loan, and also are there any restrictions? For example, does it include home loans, or does that go to through some other facility? I don't know.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we have not done home loans. We have made house payments through our system, and when people have had some severe hardships. One comes to mind where somebody came off active duty, their company disbanded, they didn't have a job. They'd spent a year on active duty and did not have a job, and we were helping them get a job, and we actually made a couple of house payments for that individual because they may have lost their house if we had not done it.
But no home loans?
No home loans. We don't have those kind of resources.
Or even deposit our initial down payments?
No, ma'am, we don't do that. We just haven't had the resources. The fund has actually averaged around $25,000, $30,000 annually. And we generate that. We have an annual military ball, which I think you've been invited to, and you may have even attended. I know Brian's been to them. And we require everybody, we don't require everybody, we invite everybody to come, all the leadership, and then we charge an exorbitant amount to the leadership to attend that function. And then we use the profits off of that to fund this fund.
Great.
And then we take donations as well. So I didn't make the last two balls. I was out of town, but I had tickets for each one of them. So, and we feed crackers and cheese to make sure everybody feels good and make them buy their own drinks, and then we profit handsomely off of that and put it in the fund.
Well, that is good. And would you look at line 10 now, 10, 11? It says this would include an Oregon member of the reserves of the armed forces of the U.S. who has been ordered to active duty and is deployed abroad. would the Guard be overseeing members of the reserves?
Madam Chair, we are considered a member of the reserve components of the United States. The Oregon Guard is. We, and I talked to Mac McDonald prior to the hearing. He would, of course, like to have the reserve in every one of these, and I'm not saying that that is a bad idea. It's just simply I don't know how we're going to manage it. We don't have a database on those. We don't have a chain of command as we use right now to get our soldiers verified and validated. It could possibly be done. I'm not suggesting it couldn't be, but I think it's going to add some extra burden to us that we're probably not really very adept at doing. Anything can be done, and we could do it. It certainly would add an extra burden, though.
Okay, and then if you go to B under there, line 12, I'm really just tearing this bill apart, aren't I? I'm not intended to, but based on what we've discussed previously and other bills, we have changed since these bills were initially drafted. This says, a member of the Guard who has been demobilized and released from federal active duty. So basically, we do not need that if we just include all members of the National Guard, right?
Yes, ma'am. And in fact, I would probably recommend that you strike that line entirely because, what we have found, probably line 12 and 13, what we have found is that, again, it isn't necessarily related to deployments. Hardships come in all shapes and sizes and forms at any given time of the year. Certainly deployments have added an extra burden. There's no question about that. And we've seen far more hardships based on deployments, particularly for those soldiers who have lost income by being deployed. And that's created great hardships on their families in some instances. Needless to say, that isn't exclusive, though. Certainly other people lose their jobs and have other calamities occur in their life, regardless if they're deployed or not. I would also ask that in line 17, where it suggests the department adopt rules, which is a favorite term of legislative counsel, we do not adopt rules in the Oregon Military Department. We write regulations.
Okay.
And we actually made testimony before this committee on one of our bills that's going to validate that even or accentuate that even more.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir. Representative Barnhart.
That would also apply, would it not, to the term rule in line 16, mm-hmm. in addition to rules in line 17?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, you're absolutely correct.
And you like a different word. What was the word?
Regulations.
Regulations.
We adopt regulations by Oregon statute. By order of the governor, we can adopt regulations. We don't do rulemaking as the other agencies do.
Okay, so then line 18.
Different procedure.
Sorry. Oh, well. Line 18 then should also read, shall establishing procedures for applying for a grant or loan. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And the criteria determining eligibility to receive a grant or loan.
That is correct.
Okay. And then for the benefit of those who would like to know how genius I am, thanks to the Department of Revenue, if you'll go to page 2, I want to, I should have had the good administrator bring you copies. We'll ask the Department of Revenue to come to our next meeting on Thursday and show you how this checkoff list. Well, come on, Deborah. Okay. Well, come on up. And did you bring copies for everybody?
I do have copies. What is it that you would like to have?
I wanted to tell them about how this checkoff process works, and if we could have copies for everyone so they could just
this or
the book, the booklets that shows the. Would you mind?
Thank you.
And would you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue.
I want to just tell you how appreciative I was. When we discussed this last week on the 10,000 signatures, by the time I got to my office, Deborah was there, had all the information we'd ever need. We were able to go over the costs, the potentials, and boy, did I learn something about checkoff lists. And I was going to say we'd bring her next time, but she's here, so we'll just briefly, we won't go into this as much as we can on Thursday because we don't have time today, but for you to see this is just unbelievable.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. And what you have now is our short form, the Form 40S. And if you look at toward the bottom of the page, the blue block has what is now on the return for charitable checkoffs. The first three items are required by statute, so those are specifically on there by Oregon law. To take those off, you would need to change the statute. The next two have met requirements. They have applied to the Charitable Checkoff Commission, and they have met the requirements to be listed on the front of the return. And those are placed there by determination of the commission. Line 30,
Excuse me, before you leave 28 and 29, could you tell the committee what they have to do to stay here?
Actually, Madam Chair, what they need to do is receive $50,000 in contributions during the two prior years.
Each year, total?
I believe it is each year. I can just verify that quickly, perhaps. The entity received $50,000 or more in at least one of the two tax years immediately preceding. So they might drop below in one year, but if they're above, the next.
Okay, and then go ahead with 30, please.
Line 30 is a result of 1999 legislation that allows charities to collect signatures. If they collect 10,000 signatures from people that believe they should be included in the instruction listings, then they can be listed in the instructions. And there are, I think, about 15 to 17 charities that are now in the instructions. So a taxpayer can pick one of those and designate the code and a dollar amount for those. So what you have really are three different categories of charities: those that are statutorily required, those that came in under the old rules and haven't fallen off because they've received at least $50,000, and then the others that are coming in under instruction listings. As I read House Bill 2737, if there is at least, if we have at least four lines, then we would be required to list this new entity on the return and remove, the commission would need to remove either Stop Domestic and Sexual Violence or AIDS, HIV, Education and Services, because then there would then be four statutorily required, and unless we could come up with another line, one of those would need to come off. And it would be the commission that would decide that, Madam Chair. It's my understanding.
So, Deborah, in our last committee meeting, I believe it was, where we voted to put the Veterans Home on here. Now, this would be a different one, so that we'd have the Veterans Home and we would have one from this bill, and you know we've got three more today along the same line. But here's what's ironic. When you get your tax pamphlet, we were just guessing. 50% of the people maybe do something with it. The rest of them give it to their CPA or a tax preparer. Never look at it. Don't even know this is on here unless their tax preparer is a veteran and says, hey, you probably want to give some of that, you know, $10,000 you got back, you know, to the veterans. Well, you never know about it because I didn't know these were on here. And anyway, also this requires that you go back to page 35 or something and read them, right, or 23 or something. So you got to go to another page, too. Now, here's what I suggested. I said, wait a minute. I want us on the front page. So just take all those blocks off. You know, we don't need $1, $5, $10. You know, everybody, if you're going to help somebody, you're giving it to the veterans, you're going to give at least $100. So just leave the blank. And put all of them on the front page. And, you know, take out this blank space between these entities. Well, whether it's possible. And then I said, well, bleed this page, you know, move this heading up, and then we've got plenty of room for all of them. Then next I said, or Deborah said, let's have a lottery where we draw out of these hat who gets on the front page this year, who gets on the back page. My concern is that if they're not here, they're not going to get there. At least when you sign this page, if you're, even if a tax preparer is preparing your income tax, you know, you're going to at least maybe see that, you know, since it's in blue. And just let everybody fill out, you know, any information that they want. So we discussed all those. We discussed having a rotation, putting in the statute that we rotate these, you know, so maybe for 5 years we'll be on the front page. And I want to show you the importance. So may you, would you hand out the other document now? This is incredible. It shows the importance of being on the front page when you see this. It's unbelievable. Those that were on the front page, you know, three times, we're all getting $100,000 or more a year.
Right.
If you're on the back page, forget it. You'll be lucky if you're there in, you know, 20 years. So this shows, for example, the non-game wildlife fund, I believe it was here since the 80s. So we're showing it in 91. But look at that. In 91, $91,000. 20,000 people gave to that fund. Look at the child abuse, you know. In 91, 24,000 people gave, 116,000. Alzheimer's, you know, 15,000 contributors, 65,000. Okay, but look down to Head Start, which is on the one of the back pages. It's not one of the top five. And in the year 2000, there are only 1,800 people contributed and only 20,000. And you can see that all the way down. Look at SMART, Start Making a Reader Today, or the Nature Conservancy, or diabetes. You know, so the moral of this story, in my opinion, is you want to be on the front page, or, you know, and in some way we make this happen. Now, we think this is bad enough that you got this book and you got to go back, you know, to page 23. And I'm not knocking the Department of Revenue because goodness knows, I mean, I don't want to be audited.
Deborah's writing a name.
You got my name right there. Did it? No, but there's also, I wanted you to know, there's also another book, and it's called "If You're a Part-Time Oregonian." So it's another tax book. And the bad thing is, I mean, there's nowhere to be listed. I also said, well, if we can't be on this page, let's be on the page adjacent to it. You know, list them all right here. So at least when you're, you know, signing this, well, then if you add four pages to a tax booklet, you know, we're talking, they're going to make us kick in. I mean, we're talking about a lot of money. But anyway, we could adapt this page and possibly do something different. I was curious about the line on the kicker. Where is that? Halfway over here it says, if there is a kicker refund, you want to donate your kicker to the state school fund. Right here on the... Right. Is that in statute?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So I'm just saying what a statute can do. And I believe y'all told us that we got back $900,000 or something in 2003, just or whatever we did this. Something like that. I can't remember exactly. So it pays off to do this. But we're going to have to really work hard on this to
Madam Chair,
be seen. Deborah.
May I just say for the record that our only concern is that we have room enough to do everything the legislature requires us to do. And it gets to be, we're very creative. You'll notice on line 8, we've actually taken one line to pick up wages, unemployment, interest, and dividends, where those used to be spaced down the form.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, we took off the other credits line because we needed room for the possibility of the Measure 30 tax surcharge, and we had a lot of feedback, negative feedback, from people who then could not use this form to file their return if they wanted to claim the political contribution credit. So we're very aware of the desire to have this more entities on the return. And if you wish to go that way, the only thing that I would ask is that you provide us flexibility and not require us to put it on there if there just isn't the room to do it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, you know, I'm grateful. Oregon's a giving state, mm-hmm. and I'm grateful for all these contributors It shows that we have, what do we have right now? 104,000 individuals who contribute something to a charitable cause, you know, on their income tax. I think that is really neat. And we see that the two that we'd have to move out because they wouldn't have generated $50,000 have. I mean, I'm glad they have, but so that's not an option for us to get one
Madam
of their
Chairman, may I just clarify that? You may want to ask the Commission, because my understanding in reading this is that even though they have met the $50,000 requirement, the Commission may have the option of rotating those entities. So those two that are on there now on lines 28 and 29, I believe, even though they've met the $50,000, could be rotated off by rule of the Commission. Now, I may be wrong on that, but that's my reading. So that might be an option to consider for the Commission to set up some sort of plan to do a rotation for those two spaces.
And it's also maybe something we want to seriously think about. As we look at these proposed bills, we have different funds, one being managed by the Department of Veteran Affairs. We have this one for the active military. And just consider every time we do this, we're going to have to find more space. I don't know if we want the veteran's name on here one time in large and bold print or several different types of funds to send monies to. But it is something we'd want to discuss. Anything else for Deborah or Colonel Caldwell? Thank you so much for being prepared and for caring. All right. If there's no Mr. McDonald, do you wish to testify on House Bill 2737?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald, representing Oregon Veterans. I just happen to be the chairman of the Charitable Checkoff Commission. And
good.
And we have three entries on the front page of the tax form. In order to get them off, the legislature would have to legislate them off. And it's been suggested several times to the Charitable Checkoff Commission that all the entries go on a rotation basis, and each year three rotate off and three rotate on, but the legislature would have to change that. Also, to get on the Charitable Checkoff list, you must be a $1 million operation. And you must operate statewide. In other words, you can't just be Multnomah County and go on the Charitable Checkoff Commission. You must, if you take contributions from the whole state, then you must give back to the whole state.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. McDonald?
On this bill, I'd like on line 11 to cross out "and is deployed abroad." As you know, in the military, you don't have any choice where you go. You're sent where you're to go. And we might have a young Coast Guardsman sent from here to, let's say, Florida or New England, or a young Marine sent to Camp Lejeune or Camp Pendleton. And I think it's grossly unfair to require National Guard just to be activated and the reserves have to be deployed overseas.
Mr. McDonald, did you hear Colonel Caldwell?
Yes, ma'am, and I have a suggestion.
Okay, thank you.
That the reserve unit be notified by somebody, either the Director of Veterans Affairs or the National Guard, both at the national and the local level, of the bills that pass and what makes the reserves eligible for these bills.
And who would administer the reserves fund?
Well, each department in the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, each have a reserve component headquarters at Washington, D.C. or Arlington, Virginia. And if you notify that reserve headquarters, they could pass the information down. But to ensure that the reserve units in the state get it, and we have, I'm sure the Department of Veterans Affairs has a list of all reserve units and the National Guard in the state, that could be passed two ways, one to the local and one to the national, so the national knows what's going on.
Okay. We're concerned about who would administer the program.
I think the National
Guard does not have a list of those in the reserves whose home of record is Oregon.
Ma'am, I think if they notify the reserve units and the reserve components at the national headquarters, then it'll be up to the reserve units to come to the National Guard. I don't see any other way of doing it other than having a big administrative mess.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. McDonald? Okay, thank you very much. Any other public testimony on House Bill 2737?
Madam Chair,
yes.
Could I make just a comment?
Sure.
The original intention of this bill was to deal with the transition issues that we were talking about earlier during earlier testimony. I can see now, as with your exchange with Colonel Caldwell, that we're talking about broadening it quite a bit, and I like the direction it's moving, because it would simplify it quite a bit and would also make it usable at times other than during the national emergency situation that we find ourselves in now. So I just wanted to add that comment to it. The suggested changes would clearly change the focus of the Oregon Military Family Relief Program, but in a good direction, I think. And I'm getting a nod from my co-sponsor over here.
Thank you. Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, if not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2737 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2845.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2845 creates an Oregon Military Child Care Grant Program, and that is also in the Oregon Military Department. For funding child care grants not to exceed, and there's a blank in there, for family, it appropriates, again, another blank in general fund to operate the program. Declares an emergency, takes effect July 1st, 2005.
Thank you. I'll call Colonel Caldwell. You might as well just stay up here all day, Colonel Caldwell, you and Mr. McDonald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I brought my briefcase, so I have plenty to
stay all night.
Yes, ma'am.
Bring your tent.
For the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. Again, House Bill 2845 is, I think the intent is quite good, and we certainly appreciate the committee's thoughtfulness and the direction that the committee is wanting to go with respect to taking care of those families who are serving. I would, however, have to tell you from official position, since it is not in the governor's budget, we could not support it because it breaks his budget. So with respect to that, I'll talk to the merits of the bill again. Currently, again, as we discussed in the previous testimony, we use our relief fund to do some of this. This is far more vast than what we have traditionally done. Our fiscal on the bill, and this is an estimate based on again how many people we've deployed in the last year, which is clearly abnormal based on the last 50 years of service of the Oregon Guard to the nation, to the state, and to the communities. Nevertheless, if it was if we would have had this bill in the last year, we estimate it would cost somewhere around $4.5 million. Now, again, I think that's a high number. I don't dispute that. It's a worst case kind of situation. We have no way of knowing. I mean, it's strictly a guess. We don't have any way to empirically define exactly what the requirement would be based on the number of mobilizations we have at this point, because we've never done anything quite like this. The intent, again, is, I think, excellent. I think the members of the Oregon National Guard that have served and have children, this could be a real benefit to them, because there's been significant hardships based on families who are traditionally two-parent families, and then all of a sudden one of the spouses mobilized and deployed for up to 2 years, and most of our deployments are running anywhere between 18 and 20 months right now. So it does create a significant hardship, and this would be a very good I think, addition to the quiver to assist these families. But again, it's certainly outside of our total general fund budget's $13 million. And this is, you know, a third of that at this point. So that kind of gives you an idea of the limitations we're under at this point.
Colonel Call, excuse me, just 1 minute here. We have called this the Oregon Military Care Grant Program. To tell you the truth, I don't know at this moment. I can't recall who proposed this bill. Almost all of the bills that have Committee on Veterans Affairs were given to us by individuals across the state, so I don't know exactly. But again, I just want to ask, we call it Oregon Military Department, and is that one thing?
Madam Chair, the, you know, and I think some of this language comes from the art of how people write and read laws. The Oregon National Guard is an entity. It's stated so in the Constitution of this state. The Oregon Military Department is the administrative arm of that Oregon National Guard, if you will. The department in itself becomes the legal entity that deals with finances, that deals with all of the associate things that we deal with respect to, you know, land transfers, purchases, sales, etc. So, in essence, it's a part of the Oregon National Guard, as the Oregon National Guard being the umbrella. And in that umbrella, you have the Air National Guard, the Oregon Army National Guard, and the Oregon State Defense Force, and the military department is the functioning agency that does the operations, I guess, for that. So I think you're not
being... Is that where the money should be appropriated, or should the money be appropriated to the Oregon Guard?
It should be appropriated to the department. That is the...
To the Oregon Military Department.
That is correct. That is the legal entity that operates the Oregon National Guard.
Okay, so if we go back up to six, then, we say the child care is so much dollars to only members of the Oregon National Guard.
Yes, ma'am. And I think it goes back to what Mr. McDonald indicated earlier in the previous bill we had the discussion. We clearly have the ability to ascertain who's members of our organization. We have that database. We have those databases. We don't have that with reserve components. We just don't know. And as we said earlier, we validate things through our chain of command where we have a direct linkage where we can push things up and down our chain of command. Once you leave that tent, it becomes more difficult to validate. It becomes more difficult to control and administer. It's just simple fact of knowledge versus no knowledge.
And again, we should take out the on active duty for a period of 30 days or more.
Yes, ma'am. I would recommend that if this bill was to move forward, that be deleted. Clearly, there are, as was stated previously, there are deployments that sometimes run less than 30 days, and they're just as equally as difficult on families.
Representative Farr, I apologize for asking more questions without putting you first.
Colonel Caldwell, my question really would be how narrow the pool of people that the child care grant would apply to. So I'm assuming that, I mean, in today's families, many times the traditional roles are reversed and sometimes dads are home because moms are working. But I'm guessing that this is going to apply more to female guardsmen who probably were home during a portion of the time to help care for the children and now they're gone. So what I'm wondering is, do we have any numbers? Is there anything that can show us how many families this would actually apply to?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I can generate those. I did not for purposes of this hearing. We took a raw number. We basically took the number of, for our fiscal impact, we took the number of deployments we have. We made an estimate based on a fairly common theme that we use within the department, and we estimated that 60% of our membership has families, and they have children. So that was why we came up with the number we came up with. I think traditionally, if you look at our institution, and I think this has been proven out in numerous studies, that the Guard and the Reserve are traditionally older than the active component. We have older members, we have more senior people, and we have a less number of single folks. So it's just a matter of statistical analysis that we could do to come up with probably a more accurate number. We use the rule of thumb that we traditionally use, which is that, you know, 60% of our people are over 18, 19, 21 years old and have families. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So then my question for you is, typically if two people are working, they're going to have child care costs.
Yes, ma'am.
So this is going to apply just to a certain percent of those who are on active duty. Because, I mean, just let me know if I'm going in the right direction, because I'm thinking that what this is designed to do is to help families who are really feeling a financial impact, because suddenly they're having to pay child care, whereas before they didn't have to apply part of their income to child care.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I would agree with your analysis. I think that, again, every circumstance is unique, but clearly what we have observed is that about 25-30% of our folks who have been mobilized have taken pay reductions. And that just seems to be kind of a rule of thumb that we've been picking up more anecdotally than empirically, but nevertheless.
Colonel Carl, what does someone make just brand new in and they're called to duty? What kind of income do they get? Are they $30,000 a year people or?
Madam Chair, the
are like Colonel Boquist $1 million for service.
Colonel Boquist gets a bonus.
Bonus for being such a good person, right?
Because he's a special forces guy, so they get extra bonuses that none of the rest of us get. But I'm not sure it's financial though. But nevertheless, I go back into my office that I brought with me, and I have a book that I can probably give you exactly what they make, but off the top of my head, a private E1 is going to make around $21,000,
$22,000,
$23,000
annually.
Is that gross? Yes, ma'am. $21,000? Yes, ma'am. And I can go back and verify that if you'd like.
Is that call to active duty $21,000?
That's annually, yes, ma'am. That's what they make per year.
What is it when they're not called out active duty?
The
poverty level? Sorry,
Paul. Yeah, it's pretty close, whether in any way you cut it. But the Guard and Reservists get what is termed drill pay, which is unique in the military system. Instead of one day's pay, you get actually 2 days' pay for a drill period. We have four drills in a two-day period, so you get 4 days' pay for 1 month's worth of duty, you know, when you do your annual Guard or Reserve duty. So you get four separate paydays in that period, four-hour periods of drill. Now, they can be divided up, and you can do 1 4-hour period on a Tuesday and one on a Wednesday and two on a Sunday, and you've got your four periods for the week or for the month. And typically, that's probably going to earn that private E1, I'm going to guess, around $200 for that month, $250.
For all that training, 200 measly dollars?
For 4 days worth of, or 2 days worth of training.
Oh, my word.
Two days of work.
Me ill.
And I've got a...
How long's it been since they had a raise, for crying out loud?
Madam Chair,
200...
Actually, the raises have been very good over the last 5-6 years.
$10 a year?
No, ma'am. The raises have been averaging 3.5%, 4.5%. Right after 9/11, the Bush administration raised military salaries 10%. So there have been significant increases over...
Appreciate the president doing that.
Yes, ma'am. The previous president was not all that ungenerous because he was actually putting 4.5 and 3.5, and you know, so there's been, I would say, since about 96, we've seen a pretty steady, you know, annual increase to get military pay up. But if you go back and you look at what Brian and I would call Volar, which was the Volunteer Army, back in the 70s, the idea was to create the volunteer army and make it competitive with civilian workforce so there wouldn't be a need for a draft. And that was the direction the Congress set out on. Obviously, that didn't occur. They did not keep the salaries in lockstep with inflation and civilian workers. And so there have been years where the salaries have stayed way behind, and over a period of 25, 30 years, suddenly you find yourself 15, 20% behind in the total. So there have been efforts, I think, well, like I said, over the last 6 years. It's been more noticeable to me since about 98. I'm not sure. I'm sure there was issues, political issues involved around that to try to make sure that everybody was showing their proper support. But clearly we've had substantial systematic increases, most notably the 10% one in October of 2001. So it has gotten better. It's still most active duty families, if you talk to young soldiers, E1, D4, pay grade E1, D4, that would be private through corporal rank in the Army, most of those qualify for food stamps. And most of those families are on food stamps because they simply don't make enough money to be, to run their families. And when you're that young and that low ranked, there isn't housing for you, so they have to go on the economy for housing. If you go around any military post, I can assure you that the renters or the landlords know exactly what the subsistence dollars are, and the rent will be probably about $200 more than what you get for subsistence. They've got it all factored and figured as public record, and that's how they establish their rents. So most of these young families are living on very, very meager income. Now, that's the bad news story. The good news story is that in Guard or Reservist, again, they don't rely on this income as their main source of income. Typically, our young soldiers, they're students. They're receiving, student loans, grants, other things that the military offers, and the $250, $300 a month becomes, a very nice stipend for them to continue on with their education. That isn't always the case, but it certainly is, some of the time. But if you're trying to make a living, raise a family on military pay from ranks, pay grades E1s, D4, I'd say you're going to have a tough time doing it.
So my thought, and I was surprised, I differed from the good representative Farr, even though having been a single mother with several children and needing child care in my life, I did liken this to the fact that the breadwinner was being sent to war, and so in order to cover just normal costs, the spouse left home's got to go to work, which then requires daycare and a huge cost. And so I was thinking more not of the single parent being sent so much as because of the low, the crummy pay, as I might say, that they're getting for risking their lives for months and months and months, their family still got to make it.
Madam Chair, may I?
Representative Farr, am I off key?
No, I think you misunderstood. Really, what I was trying to establish is, will there be an income criteria? I was just trying to set up a way to frame that question, but I mean, obviously, we're not going to be able to give a child care grant to every soldier's family.
Right.
But there are specific families that are going to be more needy than others. And so, do we have a way to? Mm-hmm. I mean, I noticed on. Sorry, I have to put my glasses back on. Let's see, I'm not sure. Oh, I see line 8. Mm-hmm. The department shall adopt regulations implementing. Establishing procedures for applying for a child care grant and criteria for determining eligibility.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, Representative Farr, that would clearly be the right way to approach this. What we did in our estimate was we estimated that we had 1,685 soldiers over the last 12 months that have been called to active duty for more than 30 days. We estimated that 60%, or around 11,000 have children based on our some, and we estimated again that 50% of those would probably meet a fairly stringent criteria, not necessarily unbearable, but certainly a reasonable criteria. So we're looking at around out of that 1,600 and some that have been activated and deployed, about 500 would qualify for a minimal substance, a subsistence of some sort. So that would probably fall along with what you're thinking. If you make it too restrictive, then of course it doesn't do any good. But at the same token, I think you've got to have some reasonable standards set up in here that would require that. And I think clearly the examples that come to my mind just off the top of my head, we had incidents where when the Air National Guard was deployed for a year, they were deployed in Portland at the airbase. So as Max said earlier, you don't get a choice where you're deployed. They tell you you're on, you're there. Several of those members, the two that come specifically to mind, were high-tech guys out of Intel that did wonderful things with our computer network at Portland Air Base and throughout the Air National Guard in Portland. Some of their stuff even went national because they were so creative and so innovative. These young men were both staff sergeants. One was an E-5, one was an E-6 sergeant and a staff sergeant. They went from $120,000 a year income to a $40,000 a year income. Took an $80,000 a year hit for 1 year. Now, I can guarantee you that they had financial difficulties, regardless of the Sailor Servicemen's Act and all of the benefits that are out there to help, you know, help those soldiers or those airmen with their particular financial needs. They still had a lifestyle that was set up on $120,000 a year income, and suddenly they didn't have that, and that was horrendous for them. I can also tell you that neither one of them re-upped. And they said, we can't do this. So,
well, should this also, excuse me, 1 minute, please, Representative Barnhart. Should this, I'm getting concerned of how we're going to do this, and Val Conley is here from the Veterans Affairs, but at some point, you know, we seem to have, our two different funds. We have veterans, and I've just, in a press release I just did, I think I spoke to that, who can have need of child care because of circumstances where the husband is very ill, has disease from Agent Orange, you know, they're losing their house. I stole the story of the veteran's wife standing in the corner in Eugene for a year trying to save her house with a cup. So is there a need to have two different funds? One seems complicated here because we're now going to be veterans, but we're still in the Guard, and then we're veterans outside of the Guard. How do you recommend we do this? Are we going to have a...
Well, Madam Chair, I think if I was be bold enough to play king for the day, I would say that we would be the least likely agency to do the best job of dealing with veterans. I think the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs does an excellent job, has a great network, and has the ability, far better than we do, to deal with veterans who are no longer in uniform serving. We, on the other hand, have a much better ability to deal with the Guard, as I said earlier about Guard versus Reserve, because we have control of that. We have databases. We have chains of command. We can use our infrastructure that's in place. I think if we were dealing with veterans as part of this, I'd certainly recommend that you bifurcate this in some fashion to allow the Veterans Affairs Department to deal with that group of clientele.
Well, it's my understanding from this committee, y'all straighten me out, that we have now determined that you may have active guard who are now veterans.
Yes, ma'am.
If they spent 1 day, you know, in a combat zone, they're a veteran. So you're going to have veteran guardsmen, and we're going to have veterans.
Yes, ma'am. And here again, I think that's not all that uncommon.
Oh.
We have a good number of veterans who are in the National Guard presently.
Okay.
They're certified, classified, you know, sanitized by the federal government, meeting all these different 182 days, you know, 191. I mean, all these different weird classifications. They meet those, and we have others that don't. We have others that didn't meet that 181 days or whatever that case may be, by luck of the draw, by injury, by, you know, a whole host of different things. So, again, I think veterans as a classification of certain rights and benefits is better dealt with within the Veterans Department than within our department. We just simply don't have the database and the functional capability to do that well.
Well, our goal here is to meet the needs, you know, of our military, our veterans, and to secure, you know, the future. A huge sacrifice. I think this is just really hits us today when we realize how little these soldiers get paid, and I mean even more. And as we continue to search for funding before this budget is rounded up and sent to the governor, I mean, I think it's imperative that we fill some of these needs for these men who have continued to fight for us, protect our property from fires and help us in floods and for freedom. So that our goal is, we don't want to complicate it, though. We want to make it simple. Goodness knows the military doesn't need any more complications in the classifications or, bureaucratic procedures. Representative Barnhart, I didn't forget you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reminded of one of the reasons why we drafted many of these bills is to... there's a constellation of reasons, but one of the reasons was something that you just reminded me of, and that is re-upping or initial recruitment.
Good point.
And one of the things that I was interested in, and I think other members of the committee too, were the extent to which we can influence people deciding to join the Guard in the first place or re-upping after they've been in. And the question that comes from that, for this bill at least, is... Would a capacity of this sort on your part, because of a fund from the legislature, from the general fund, assist in the process of getting people to reenlist or to in the Guard or to join in the first place? What's your sense of it?
Madam Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I think anything we can do that enhances the family stability of Guard members is going to help us in retention. The number one reason that people state for getting out of the Guard nationwide is family pressures. Number two reason is job. So those are the two top tier items that we know emphatically that cause our membership to not re-enlist after their first term. And I think if you take the typical National Guardsman or reservist that is a citizen soldier, they join when they're 18, 19 years old, male or female, doesn't matter. Gender doesn't seem to matter. By the time they finish their six-year enlistment, a lot of things in their life has changed. That's changed dramatically. They've probably completed college if they went. If not, they've worked in jobs, several jobs, but by the end of that 6 years, they have a job that they see themselves being in for a number of years. And they are stable, but yet they're young in that position. They're not seasoned in that particular employment. And they've usually acquired a house payment, a car payment, a spouse, and 1.5 kids. So, I mean, if you do the math and you go ask these soldiers why they're leaving and not reenlisting, and number one is always family. They've got family commitments that and they have a fear that if they stay in the Guard and they continue to leave for 2 weeks in the summer or face 18-month deployments, that they will not be viewed very favorably in their work environment. So whether that's true or perceived, it doesn't matter. It just, you know, it's a perception. Perception's reality, and they get out. So anything that we do as collectively, as a legislature or Congress or as a people, to enhance them staying in the Guard or the Reserve is better for us, because it will help ease that burden and that fear that they have, and it's a real fear. So I think that follows along with that very well.
Thank you. And if I could follow up, and you've probably said this before, and I simply don't remember. What percentage of your enlistments are people who are re-upping as compared with people coming in new?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, traditionally we've done very well in Oregon with reenlistments by national standards. We traditionally reenlist 80% of those eligible. 20% do not reenlist after their first term. That's been our pretty much standard number that we've dealt with. We've done as well as 15%, and we've done as poorly as maybe 23-24%, but very rarely have we seen it go above 25%. Best example I can give you is the 1st Battalion 186th Infantry out of Southern Oregon, headquartered in Ashland. They did 9 months in the Sinai, 3 months train up, 9 months in the Sinai, gone for a year. Within the year after they returned from their deployment, we only got 50% of those available. So we had a 30% reduction in reenlistments in that one battalion. The next one we're studying right now very closely is the 1st Battalion 162nd Infantry, and they deployed at the beginning of the war in Iraq and were gone for, I think, 18 months total. Right now we're right around 70-72%. However, we haven't got all the numbers in yet. In September, we had a bunch of, and I suspect that we had them in September because we had enlistments in September for young men and women who wanted to go to college. So they enlisted in September. Well, their 6 years came up in September. And if we backdated 6 years, that's when we started the state tuition assistance program, when the federal government wasn't doing much in that regard. And we had a huge enlistment. We had 111 people get out of that one unit in September of this last year. And up to that point, we've been running around 75-78% reenlistments after their deployment, and it just plummeted. So I don't know what the aggregate is now, but I think it's around 60%. So we're seeing a significant reduction. No matter how you cut it, deployments have a significant impact on reenlistments.
I was amazed just on the news to hear so many had reenlisted, had taken the $15,000 bonus to sign up the 162nd.
Yes, ma'am.
So proud of all of those men and women, and I just thought, my goodness, and to hear their comments of how proud they were of what they'd accomplished, and yes, they'd go back, and they felt needed, and they felt they had a purpose, and they felt they'd accomplished. I just thought it was awesome.
I might add, just as an anecdotal piece to that, we're the first state of all the National Guard states that we're aware of who did send a retention person into Iraq with their units. National Guard Bureau was so impressed with what they saw come out of the 2162 that they put it out as a standard. They want every state to start doing that, to go out. And the real question is, should we have been there earlier? It was 3 months early enough. Should we have gone there 5 months, 6 months earlier? And again, I don't know the psychology behind all of that. Clearly, $15,000 tax-free has an impact, and I think that was significant, and it made a big difference with those soldiers.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah, another question, sir.
Is there any other?
Based on this line of discussion, I wanted to make just one comment then, and that is, when we're talking about the issue of the Guard versus the Reserves, it seems to me that if part of our concern is to make sure we're dealing with retention in the Guard, perhaps the discussion about the reserves is less significant to us in this bill and perhaps in some other bills as well. In addition to having some administrative issues, it may also cloud the purpose of the bill.
You know, we have the head of our American Legion is here. Will you come forward, sir, please? And Mr. McDonald, could you stay where you are, Colonel Caldwell? We've got enough room, and we're so honored to have you here today. And since
thank you,
you men probably can.
My name is Harley Raish. I'm a retired Army colonel. I'm also the legislative chair for the American Legion. And I'm here to...
We're so honored, and thank you for being here and taking the time to be here. Could you just speak to this, how the reserve issue versus how would you...
I'm glad you asked that, because I was in the reserves. Oh. I started out in the National Guard, went into the reserves, and I went on active duty.
Right.
But the reservists are Oregonians, whether in the National Guard or whether they're in the reserve. and they call up, they have the same problems we do. I think as Oregonians, we are responsible for helping them out as well as our National Guard members.
We appreciate that coming from you. Mr. McDonald, do you have a position on this one?
For the record, my name is Matt McDonald, and represent DAV VFW, ex-prisoners of war, military order of world wars, and the Military Officers Association. A couple of comments. We have several bills that address only the National Guard, and on all those bills, I'll be up here pushing for the reserves. The reserves don't have people here because I don't know whether they're allowed to or not, but I know in the Marine Corps, if you dealt with politicians, you got a pee on your, you used to get a pee on your service jacket, and sometimes that affect promotions. Even though, I was at Headquarters Marine Corps, I testified before the Senate and the House on a national level for the Marine Corps. But on all these bills, we're going to have to figure a way to include the reserves and Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, and Marine Corps of all activated reserves, and they are Oregonians, and they should be treated the same as the National Guard. So we're going to have to figure some way of communicating to them that these things are available and treat all Oregonians the same. And I can see where we have problems because I know the Department of Veterans Affairs doesn't have the people to, you know, administer this, and I doubt if the National Guard has people to administer this. So either we establish another person or two persons at some place to help coordinate the reserve and the National Guard bills, and I think we need to prioritize the bills like you do on zero-based budgeting. You have a list of everything, and you have so much money, and when you reach the level where there's no more money, those things are going to have to drop off. And the thing we need to, when we prioritize, is personnel is number one, the people. Other things like naming streets or something like that would be at the bottom of the list. But we do have a problem in communications, and it's going to have to be solved, I think, by adding a couple of people to either the Department of Veterans Affairs or the National Guard to coordinate all of this.
Thank you. Are there any other questions about House Bill 2845? Representative Hunt.
This may be most best directed to Colonel Caldwell. As we start to look at all these bills that are going to have a variety of fiscal impacts, as Representative Farr and I were just discussing, we've got a whole series of subsequent referrals to Ways and Means here, and I think the more bills we send out to Ways and Means, the more risk that they're all going to collapse upon each other and never make it out. If you were to, I realize you identified the $4.5 million, if this were fully implemented and applied to everybody and to a full level, but if it were a much smaller amount of money, if it were $50,000 for this, would there be greater value in having $50,000, for instance, specifically designated into a child care grant program, or that same $50,000 put into a broader military family relief fund, one component of which would be meeting child care needs? I mean, from a retention standpoint, from a giving folks a sense that their needs are met, because it's not like we're going to have $50,000 for each of 100 things. What's your reflection on that? Realizing you officially don't support any of these bills.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, thank you for that official designation. I think if you look at the way we've been able to operate our relief fund and look at the, you know, the laundry list of assistance that we've given for numerous things, everything from diapers to rent. We've even made some car payments in some horrendous situations. I think from my standpoint, from the Guard standpoint, we'd be better off to have any resources we could put into our relief fund, into a relief fund. either use the one we have currently or, you know, codify it in the statutes. I said earlier in Representative Barnhart's bill, the fact that we could get a check off and get other people to contribute to it is enticing. We've never done this well with respect to donations. And I think clearly the need, the war, the media, all the things that have caused that have created a fairly decent fund for us right now. And that, to me, would be the best place to do it because we could do a multitude of different tasks with it, not just simply one narrow task. So that would be my, again, king for the day hat. If I had it on, that's what I would say, because we can do a wider variety of assistance to needy people, to our soldiers and our airmen.
Mr. Ray, do the associations, the American Legion, the AMVETS, the Veterans of Foreign War, and all of them, do they have any funds? Do they? I know you've been. I've always say the veterans are the best at taking care of the veterans, and I appreciate it. I know I've gone to a lot of benefits. I've done as an auctioneer. I've auctioned for them, and but I don't know if there's a specific ongoing fund.
There's not. Really, that type of a fund.
Madam Chair, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, each post will help veterans that come in and can prove they're veterans, and it's almost on a daily basis with Post 661 here in Salem. Because when we're working down there on a military display, we have people come in that want gas money, bus tickets, rent money, etc. And fortunately, we run a bingo game that provides us some funds. And part of the bingo game is if you bring food in, you get an extra bingo card or something like that. But we, yes, we do, in the Veterans of Foreign Wars, we do help veterans. But they must be able to prove that they are a veteran, either a DD-214, a retired ID card, or something along that nature. And I'm sure that's true throughout the state.
When, for an example, when Albany B-52 was called up, my post there took on giving to the family support group money to help the families. And he mentioned the bingo. Well, we used to use one game of bingo a week. Profits from that went into that fund. So the post, the American Legion and all, do post do support our veterans.
Well, you're wonderful. I just want you to know that. And I know how many that I've attempted to or found jobs for. And I what's happened in my area, or, well, I guess really all over the state, but a lot of them who are waiting for their disability, I mean, they're really hurt for a period of time when one of the parents can't work. And so I know I've had to get them electricity discounts, and thanks to the St. Vincent de Paul and YCAP, the food organizations, we've been able to keep them going, the housing assistance. But, I mean, you have to pull from lots of areas, and right now with so many unemployed, you know, you got a lot that who aren't veterans are in the military. So thank you so much. Are there any other questions about 2845? Did you get your answer?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Hunt, what was it?
I, Madam Chair, as I understood the answer, it would be that if we're dealing with limited dollars, that they would be better focused on the A Family Relief Program, if I understood the Colonel correctly.
Instead of a specific area. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I might just add, I did the math. I've got my little glossary out. And an E-1 on active duty makes $14,820 annually.
14
plus $269
what?
A month non-taxable.
14 what?
$14,820.
18-year-old.
An 18-year-old E-1 in the military.
And 200 and what a month?
$269 a month for basic allowance for housing. Non-taxable at 269. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, while that is a low amount, it's much better than when I went in at $78 a month. And when I was commissioned in Korea, my check went from about $110 a month to $222 as a second lieutenant. So we've made vast improvements in the military, but I've still had to take some of my people between private and sergeant down to the get food stamps and things like that. So there still is a problem in the lower ranks.
I know from my hunger task force I've been on for a long time that a lot of our recipients are our military, and it always breaks my heart. And I recall that when I started teaching that I think I took home $400 a month. Mm. So times have changed. But you know, you weren't making money back then.
Yeah, but we still can't get a quart of milk for 8 cents or a loaf of bread for 11 like we used to.
30 years later, making $1,200 a month. So I really moved up. Okay.
I might add, Madam Chair, that a guardsman or reservist gets $164.68 per month for four drill periods or 2 days. And then on top of that, they get $2,593 for their annual training. So they're annually going to make around $4,500 in the guard.
Okay, I'm getting depressed. All right. Well, let's move on if we can. I'll now, unless there's more testimony on House Bill 2845. You gentlemen can stay right there. We're going to hit one more here. But I've got to tell the truth, what I learned. The truth sets you free. And over the weekend, when I was here working, a veteran came to me and said, Donna, you want the good news or the bad news? And I always want the good news. Well, the good news is that one time there was a committee on veteran affairs. And there was also a committee on military at the same time. And that was 50 years ago. So it was nice. And I want to thank Mike Sullivan for bringing us up that research and recognize those individuals who had that foresight for, I don't know, for that brief period of time. Maybe if we'd have stayed on it, our soldiers wouldn't be making $15,000 a year. If we'd have kept that committee, we'd have had somebody really fighting for them over here where the dollars are banked. And I think the citizens of this state who are our bankers, you know, need to know that, you know, our military is getting paid so little. And I don't think they'd be happy to know that. All right. Well, did I already close that? I think I did. Okay. I'm sorry. Our administrator's giving me an alert about how slow I'm moving today. Well, these are complicated issues. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2860 and for 5 minutes.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2860 creates a military transition assistance program in the Oregon Military Department to provide assistance to Oregon National Guard members returning from active federal duty. It appropriates a blank amount of general fund to operate the program, declares emergency, takes effect July 1st, 2005.
Okay. No surprise to us that we have Colonel Caldwell and Mac McDonald, and we're grateful to have Mr. Ray join us, the Director of our American Legion for the State of Oregon. And would you men give us an opinion on this bill, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2860, I think, is more of the same genre that we've been discussing with respect to transition assistance after the fact, after deployments. Again, from the department's official position is that we are, can't support the bill because it's not in our budget. Our estimate is that it would take $5.4 million based on the last year, 2005-2007, and roughly the same for 2007-09 based on what we think. And we know at this point who will be mobilized and how many soldiers would be mobilized. Although the bill's intention, I think, is honorable and good, as in the previous acts, it's not within the governor's budget, so therefore we would have to decline support for it. I would recommend that if the bill goes forward that on line 7 and 8, where we talk about rules, again, we change that to regulations, amend that so we have consistency within the statutory language with respect to how we do business.
And I hope Legislative Council is listening or watching this morning and you know, will become as good as we are at using our military jargon and will now say regulations and not rules, right? Is this a similar one to the previous ones that we need to discuss how we're going to, or is this a separate issue, how we're going to put this in the benefit package?
Madam Chair, representing the committee, I think, again, we're talking about what Representative Hunt brought up earlier, is that you have a similar situation, similar kind of needs, and probably the best thing to do would be to collapse that into one particular piece of legislation that deals with the relief fund that covers a matriot of situations, and therefore we reduce the statutory language. We can combine it all into one, be a lot easier to administer, and certainly cover those same needs, because that's what we do now.
Well, I have great concern for the fact that you have no funds with which to do your risk assessment by having regular meetings with, for example, the 162nd, who just came home. This is my understanding. They have 2 weeks after they put their feet on U.S. soil, and then you probably don't see them again for 6 months. Am I right or wrong?
Madam Chair, the current scenario is that, and again, we've learned some lessons from previous deployments of Oregon Guardsmen. The current program is that they will spend approximately 10-14 days in a out-processing format. At the conclusion of that out-processing, then they are released for 90 days. However, we are looking at and we were directed by National Guard Bureau because they're still on Title 10 duty during that 90-day period. Best portion of that is probably close to 50 to 60 days to burn leave up. So they're still on federal active duty until that leave is depleted. We are in the process of offering, or maybe even directing, depending on whether Guard Bureau will allow it, that we order them into a drill status at 30 days because we're concerned about the disconnect that we will have with these folks who are experiencing difficulties and not going to the appropriate places like the Veterans Affairs to seek assistance. That could be financial, it could be mental health, it could be employment. And so we have ramped up significantly from the first deployments of the last year, or returns. And we will have those folks in. Our first thought is to invite them in, more of a social thing, but also pay them.
And they could, so would this be paid by the federal government?
Yes, ma'am.
Because they're currently under this 90-day.
Yes, ma'am. And
so what if, how do they get assessed after 90 days? I mean, let's say the mental stress does not materialize in 90 days.
It's a concern. It's a very much.
So where is the funding for the leadership to have opportunity to speak with these men and women and understand them? And because you're the ones that can identify with what they've been through.
Madam Chair, again, you're absolutely correct, is we don't have a physical nose count of these folks during that period because of these requirements to give them this leave. However, there is one bill that's, I don't remember if we testified on it yet or not, but I've seen it written. I'm losing track, but where we would actually have the ability to, we have the ability now, but this would make a requirement that we could call them into state active duty for a day and bring them in for briefings and assessment, if you will. That we have that ability to do that right now. The governor could tell us to do that, or we could determine that and ask the governor to allow us to do it, where we could order them into state active duty. We'd pay them with state funds. However, we think, again, we've made a request to Guard Bureau to allow us to not comply with the 90-day rule that they've established, which says you won't touch them for 90 days. We're saying that's a mistake. We're saying that's wrong. We need to bring them in. They don't necessarily have to be in uniform. They can have a full beard. We don't care. We want them in to touch them, you know, and let them reintegrate them, re-inform them of the services that are available through the standard systems as they are today. We think that's going to work. We think that the Bureau is considered it favorably at this point. So we believe that this unit, when 2162 is the test example, that we'll be able to bring them in at 30 days for a four-hour period and offer those same resources that they're going to see this week. But they're not going to be all that interested this week, and you've heard testimony to that regard. And they're not going to be all that excited about listening to more briefings. They're going to want to get the hell out of there and go back and back to their real life. So we're going to offer it on a, like a Thursday and a Friday and a Saturday, three different sessions. Say we want every one of you guys to touch base with this unit on these days, and we will have assistance teams there to deal with those issues and to give them input and to give them guidance as to where they can seek out any assistance they may need, to include perhaps the Oregon National Guard Relief Fund if they have difficulties and employment, which is a big issue. 40% of this battalion is unemployed when they get home. So we're dealing very, very hard or aggressively on that. We've established a reintegration team. This is new. We didn't do this on our first deployments because we learned some lessons painfully. And some of those numbers I told you about in retention, we think are directly attributed to us not doing proactive things. So we're trying to do that more proactive at this point. We've established that team. We're resourcing it out of Hyde. We've taken two federal funded people who are actually funded by the federal government on U.S. Code Title 10. They drop off in 60 more days. They'll be off Title 10. Then we got to consume them into either state pay or some other federal pay system that we might be able to raid. I'm raiding our fuel and light budget.
Your utility
budget. Because we've had a good winter. We didn't spend as much money as we thought we would. So I was able to remove money out of there to pay two people to run this reintegration team out of that fund. And I've got them on temporary employee status, and they're working it aggressively right now. We also have informed the administration, who has accepted that and not given us the head nod to pursue it at our budget hearing in April. And in April, we will ask the Ways and Means Committee to allow us to establish two positions for the duration of the biennium for this very issue, state-funded positions. So we're going to ask for that in our budget.
Well,
for reintegration.
I'm not,
that isn't a lot, but it's...
Yeah. I'm not sure, there's no reason, I don't think, Mr. Administrator, why that couldn't be a part of this bill that's got a very... general relating clause.
That's correct.
Could provide for two people. Any remarks?
Mayor, do you have a question?
Yes.
For Colonel Caldwell?
Yes. Representative Focus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. During the 90-day transition period, and first I would say, Representative Hunt and I went over and Hunt, The National Guard and the military are doing an exceptional job with the help of with veterans and employment and everybody else. And I think this will probably be a model transition.
I want to compliment you too. I think it's absolutely incredible.
The
media should be focusing on this right now.
And I think it will have a definite impact and a definite improvement from past rotations that have happened. But my follow-on question kind of relates to that, Madam Chair, and that is that are you going to retain the battalion and the company commanders in position for 90 days or plus so that those commanders and leaders who will know that there are problems with individual soldiers are in those command positions? Because I know previously we've had problems where we've rotated commanders within days of them coming back. And these are the key people who can recognize mental health problems, employment problems, during these four-hour blocks of periods that you're talking about.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, you bring up an excellent point. As I said earlier, we have a vast number of lessons learned from previous redeployments. And what you just pointed out is one of those. We did move leadership out very quickly. That was deemed a huge mistake. And right now the plan is that we leave them in for at least 90 days, and the preference would be to leave them in for 6 months. The earliest projected rotation of leaders is September at this point. So they'll be coming home in April, and we'll move leaders in September. And I think your points were very well taken. Why we didn't figure that out on the front end with the other deployments is beyond me. I mean, this is the blinding flash of the obvious, and we recognized it and said this is not the way we need to do business. We need to leave that leadership in place.
Just one point. To the defense of the National Guard, when I arrived at Baghdad almost 18 months ago, we had just captured Baghdad, and the active component decided to change 100% of the leaders.
In Baghdad?
Yes. Within days of the ending of immediate combat actions, which had exactly the same impact. So,
good point, Colonel Boquist.
They made a bigger screw-up, so at least the National Guard recognized quickly that there was a mistake made and took correction.
All right, are there any other questions regarding this bill? 5 minutes has passed, and...
Ma'am, again...
Make a statement, Mr. McDonald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on this, again, the reserve should be included, and I want to tell you what the state of Massachusetts did.
Okay.
In transitioning back from the Korean War, every veteran that served in Korea was given a bonus, and everyone that served in the state was given a lesser bonus. And that was used for transitioning back into public life, civilian life. But and I think that would cover most of your transition problems. But this is just really a thank you for serving. And those who served in combat got a little more than those that did not.
Very good point. Mr. Ray, do you have any comment on this bill? Okay, if not, no questions from the committee. We almost made 5 minutes. I close the public testimony hearing on House Bill 2860. I'll open a hearing on House Bill 2864. Mr. Administrator, could you move a little faster?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2864 creates a veteran discharge stipend program with the Department of Veterans Affairs to provide temporary discharge Act of Federal Service, authorized the Department Director to establish application procedures and eligibility criteria, appropriates a blank amount of general fund to operate the program, declares an emergency, takes effect July 1st, 2005.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to ask Val Conley to come forward from the Department of Veteran Affairs, and you gentlemen can stay right there, if you will, please. And Mr. McDonald, Mr. Ray. And welcome, Valerie. You've been very patient today. Well, you always are. And you look nice.
Thank you very much. And I was going to tell you, Madam Chair, that you own red.
Oh, thanks. How do you feel about this House Bill 2864? Is it constructed appropriately?
Well, Madam Chair, after listening to the testimony on the other bills here this morning and really not having any background information on any of these bills, my thinking is that an emergency relief fund should be established with different qualifiers, such as child care, rental relief, anything that has an emergent purpose. Right now I administer, I think, five or six separate trust funds, and each trust fund has a different purpose. I mean, one is for purchase of state flags for schools, one is for widows of veterans with emergent needs, another is for disabled veterans. So each one has a different purpose, and each fund has a different dollar amount in them. Some
how are these attached? Are these the 501(c)?
These are funds donated by deceased people. They're bequeathed funds to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And they usually establish a purpose where they want the funds to go to.
And do we use the principal or do we...
We have to.
We don't live on the interest.
Correct. We have one fund that is large enough that we can pretty much live on the interest. The rest of them, they may have $1,000, $2,000 in them.
I see. Okay. Mr. McDonald, do you have...
Ma'am, when I left...
Concerns on House Bill 2864?
When I left the service, of course, you get your what monies are due you for travel, your regular pay, and what leave you had on the books you get paid for. I just think that there needs to be a stipend, and as I said before, maybe what they did in the state of Massachusetts might be the answer for this. And Massachusetts was not the only state. Several states that I worked in after that throughout the United States were stationed in, I know, gave the stipends to their veterans. All veterans.
Mr. A, could you speak to House Bill 284, please?
Yes, it's when you get out, you do get some money. For example, during after the Vietnam War, some of the officers were giving what we called a RIFT, or removed from active duty, due to the downfall of the Department of the Army and so forth. I mean, reducing the people. And just giving an example, at that time I was RIFT out of the active duty, and I got a full amount of $15,000. Now, I was a major at the time, and that was not in 1973, which is, you know, was not too bad, but
right.
We were talking about the fund. It did assist me when I got out, sure, to help. And we do need to do each person and treat each person equally on this. And if we could do it within the state when they come back, I think it's great. Would be great.
Well, we had a discussion, if you recall, where we say we changed our wording on discharged from duty. How did we say that for other than a dishonorable discharge, Mr.
Discharged under honorable conditions, Madam Chair.
Under honorable conditions, okay.
That would be either an administrative, a general, or an honorable discharge. All three can get under honorable conditions. That would exclude bad conduct discharge, dishonorable discharge, and undesirable discharge.
Okay. And what were the three?
The
conditions be
honorable, general discharge, or administrative discharge.
An administrative.
They can be the under honorable conditions or not under honorable conditions.
Okay.
The administrative and the general.
Back in this bill, honorable conditions. And one question on this one when we were looking at it. I don't know what you do. Do you, Colonel Caldwell, you're going to have to join us probably on this one. But when you go from the Air Force, for example, to a reserves or to the Guard, we'd hate to be providing people with a reason to move from service to service. Have we done that here? Do you want to go from...
No.
You got to discharge.
Okay. So having a stipend would not cause...
If we treat all equally, ma'am, there'd be no reason to move.
Okay. Well, that one just came up, so I don't know how you move from a reserve to a guard. Or Mr. Ray, you've done it, so active to...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when you're in the reserves, you always have the option of joining the regulars, and they will give you either a general or an honorable discharge normally. But you can leave the reserves to join the regulars, but this is the option of the individual.
Okay. I just wish I had done so I could talk from the heart and haven't been there. But I think I'm too old now. Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just point out one of the issues that I raised. Colonel Caldwell previously mentioned that 40% of the 2162 will be unemployed. They will be eligible for unemployment benefits, yes, too, once, yes, they come out.
Yes.
Thank you so very much, Representative Boquist. Lisa, what is that?
400 a week.
They make just slightly more. $400 more than state representatives, which isn't much. Okay, is there any other discussion on House Bill 2864?
Madam Chair, may I just add that
yes.
The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs would fully support any added benefits for Oregon veterans.
Val, would this require another FTE?
Potentially. We don't know what the initial need would be. Colonel Caldwell would probably have a better sense of that than I would. It depends. It depends on how large the program is, how well funded it is, and how many veterans could potentially use it. We don't know that at this point.
Again, from active federal service, I don't know how we deal with that one. So we'll just put it on our to-do list to clean up this bill, and we know you'll all help us. All right. If there are no more questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2864, open a public hearing on House Bill 2602 and House Bill 2684 with the good news for everybody that in our enthusiasm to find out what's right, do what's right, so things turn out right for our veterans, our military. We had filed two identical bills. And that's where we are. So if we testify on one, and we'll just take them in order. So we'll take House Bill 2602. How this occurs is that various members of our veteran auxiliaries, our communities, our associations, former reservists or military men and women suggest these items, and so they took it to more than one person, and our legislative council drafted two of the identical bills. So, Colonel Caldwell, will you speak to House Bill 2602 as soon as our good administrator tells us what these are?
These are identical bills, or nearly identical. They create Oregon Military Emergency Financial Relief Program within the Oregon Military Department to provide hardship grants not to exceed $2,000 to families of deployed Oregon National Guard soldiers. It appropriates a blank amount of general fund for the program. Declares emergency takes effect July 1st, 2005.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Again, this bill has not been considered in part of the governor's budget, so from an official standpoint, we can't support the bill. However, I would say that, again, we've been discussing this whole theme this morning, and I think it falls right along with what we currently do in the Oregon Military Emergency Relief Fund. Presently, our calculation is that about 5% of the total deployed people have actually sought and received assistance from our military relief fund. Now, having said that, as you heard in testimony earlier, there are numerous numbers of funds out there that have been created at the local level to include the VFW, American Legion, and other groups that have stepped forward to assist families. So I think that 5% is not accurate with respect to the other assistance that's been rendered. We also don't know how many folks in our family program have sought other types of assistance through food banks and other types of services that are in a community. So nevertheless, we estimated that probably around 100 people would be, looking backwards, would have probably done this. If we'd have done it, and that cost came up to $357,797. Again, we estimate that about 0.25% of a person would be required to administer this. Presently, we do it, like I said, out of Hyde. I suspect that would be the same situation here. We just have to redirect some of the duties. So that might not be a completely accurate estimation in that. Last thing I would say is that on line 8, again, we talk about rules, and we would prefer that the bill is forwarded, that we change that to regulations.
Colonel Caldwell, when you've been given these grants or loans for the Guard, have any of them been as high as $2,000?
Madam Chair.
I'm not sure where we got this number.
Madam Chair, traditionally, no. The average would probably fall closer to $1,000 to $1,200. Eight to 12 would be the average. However, having said that, I know for a fact, as I said earlier, with the restriction on there, we would have been prevented from doing what I mentioned earlier about loaning money, not granting money, but loaning money. Maybe the term grant is the key here, but yeah, grant, hardship grant. We've been able to do all kinds of things with respect to helping families out.
Well, you've been awesome. I want you to know.
Well, certainly it's not been, I mean, I'm proud to take credit for my colleagues, because there's a whole lot of people that work on this and make it happen beyond me.
And our veteran organizations have just been incredible. So do you think we should even have a, on a hardship category, do you think we should have a dollar amount?
Madam Chair, I'd recommend no. I think that, again, we'll develop regulations that establish. I think we can do that certainly within the confines of our ability and our knowledge based on 10 years we've been running this relief program. And I think we'd be able to establish regulations that would satisfy any given audits and or reasonableness to how we administer the money.
Let me ask the individuals representing you. When someone gets a grant, do they have to report that? Is that taxable?
Oh, I don't know. And had nothing to do with that sort of.
Representative Comp or Bob Quister?
Madam Chair, I would assume the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. I think it is.
Yeah. It's income.
It's income. I think it is taxable. Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Park.
And then would we also be deleting line 7, where it says to members of the Oregon National Guard on active duty for a period of 30 days or more? We just stop at to members of the Oregon National Guard on active duty.
Yeah, and that's debatable, guard.
All right, to members of the Oregon National Guard and reservists on active duty. Does that meet with everyone's approval?
Does it have to be on active duty? On a hardship grant?
Colonel Caldwell?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I would recommend no. As I said earlier, I think that we're replete with examples of young soldiers and run into difficulty, no fault of their own, and we extend grants and loans to them, so this would be restrictive, and we'd prefer not to have that kind of restriction.
Thank you. Mr. McDonald and Mr. Ray, would you have a... I know what we take into consideration your good points about reserves.
Okay.
So I want
just
you
reserves,
that.
But I'd also add and loans. Wherever you see grants. I put and loans there, because I know in the service many times the Navy Relief, Army Relief, etc. does grants, but it also does loans if the person has the ability to repay. And that allows more money to go out to more people.
Yeah. You know, we are going to have to do some research. We get the good Revenue Committee with us, because if these are set up as, 501(c) entities versus a direct deposit to a state entity like the military department, there are probably more benefits.
Madam Chair, representing the committee, I would concur. The currently, and we researched this in some other areas, looking at our museum, for instance, for getting donations. With a 501c3, you actually get a tax benefit. Donate to the state, you get one, but it's limited, it's smaller, and it's not as great. You get it for state write-off, but you don't get it for federal, or it's a lesser percentage, is what the smart people told me. So we went to 501c3 to in order to get the full benefit, because people expect that when they donate money.
So we will likely, Mr. Administrator, need to bring someone in from the corporate division who can tell us how these would be best constructed for the giver and the receiver, if you wouldn't mind. If you have time. Representative Farr?
Madam Chair, thank you. It just occurred to me, reservists are actually employed by the federal government versus National Guard that's employed
by
state.
Yes, that's correct.
Is there a program similar to the one that we're talking about at the federal level?
Yeah, at the federal, Madam Chair, Representative, at the federal level, once you're activated, and this is for all services, the Army has the Army Relief, Navy, Marine Corps, Navy Relief, Air Force has Air Force Relief. But when they come back, there is no program. Once you come back here, I know of no program for the Marine Corps Reserve or Navy Reserve. They might be able to go to that Army Relief, Navy Relief, etc., but I've never heard of it being done.
Madam Chair, follow up, please. Does it make sense, though, that maybe one of the avenues that we look at taking for reservists is at the federal level, working with our congressional delegation and seeing what can be provided for?
These relief agencies are not federal, ma'am. They belong to, it's a relief agency, and it's separate from the federal government. It has not, all the monies in the Army Relief and Air Force and Navy Relief are donated monies, I believe. I don't believe there's any federal money given to these relief agencies whatsoever.
We will do further investigation. Good point, Representative Barnhart. Any other questions regarding this?
Yes,
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Does the department, I'm not sure quite how to ask it, so let me say what I'm aiming for here. I'm trying to understand how you connect with the 501c3s that are connected to the department. And I guess the specific question I wanted to ask was, does the military department have the current authority to establish nonprofit corporations for a variety of purposes like this, or do you have to go through somebody else in order to do these sort of things? And I guess a piece of the question is can you set up these kinds of entities that work in conjunction with funds that are set up through the general fund but are administered separately for tax purposes?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, the current system that we have is a separate 501c3 with a separate charter, meets the tax codes. Clearly, it's within the military department. This may be one of these questions you don't ask because you don't want the answer, but we established this thing 10 years ago we saw a bona fide need to help our people, and we had no other way to do it. So we set this fund up, and as I said earlier, we tax ourselves in order to fund it throughout those lean years. Whether or not the Department of Administrative Services would authorize that, I've never asked the question. They may tell us that we legally can't do it. I don't know.
We'll have to investigate, I guess.
A comment on that, if I may.
Great idea.
You know, I suppose that a group of officers could get together during their lunch hour and establish a corporation and establish a board of directors of the corporation to have certain qualifications on their lunch hour without any reference to the state and just happen to dovetail the thing. I don't suppose there's any particular reason why they couldn't do that.
Well, they already have one, so I guess they probably did it, probably.
Well, maybe I've answered my own question. I guess the comment I'd make in addition to that is if we're going to appropriate money from the general fund, it's going to be through a state-administered fund, or the treasurer will have our debt.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, you're absolutely correct, and I think that we do have such an organization. It's called the Oregon National Guard Association, which is separate and distinct and separate from the Oregon Military Department, but it's also authorized in the statutory language of our ORSs, where there is one little paragraph that says the Oregon National Guard, Oregon Military Department may establish the Oregon National Guard Association. So we did put that in the statute several years ago, and I'm sure that some super smart JAG said, you better get this in order to CYA. So we did that. I didn't do it. Somebody did it. It's been there as long as I recall. As respect to 501c3s, this is separate and distinct from both of those groups. We also have a 501c3 in a morale and welfare fund at Camp Rialia. That is, again, separate from distinct. We don't audit it. We don't monitor it. It's monitored through the CPA and filings with the Department of Revenue. So it operates
clearly at the assistance to assist soldiers and people who travel into Camp Rialia. They buy things like washing machines, dryers for soldiers that we don't have state funds or federal funds to buy. So that's, it got established, and it takes profits from different events that they hold, et cetera, to do that. So I think you're correct.
Any other comments, gentlemen, or from anyone else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We couldn't have three and plus thou more distinguished individuals today to testify, and we're grateful and appreciate the young man who took the time to write a testimony or give one today. I will now close the public hearing on House Bills 2602 and 2684. And if there's no other comment, I would once again invite our military to join us, Colonel Caldwell, when they're in town on the 31st. We'd be delighted. And also on April the 1st, in the House session, we'd be honored to honor them if they happen to be around, and rather than take them from their families, but it would be our privilege, our honor.
I'll pass that along.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here today. Your turn.